The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of Dartmouth.
Mouth.
Fall of 2014 was going to be a big one for residents of Chicago's many diverse neighborhoods. A summer's worth of community festivities and family activities and events culminated with a spectacular live event produced by Red Moon.
The Great Chicago Fire Festival on October 4th will be an exuberant citywide expression of creativity and spectacle on an unprecedented scale.
On October 4th of 2014, crowds gathered after days of unseasonably cold and rainy weather to see the marquee event, the burning of three model houses constructed in the middle of the Chicago River. Dazzling and dramatic, the resulting inferno would recall the 1871 blaze that leveled the city and led to its rebirth. Here's Jim Lasko, Executive Artistic Director of Red Moon, remembering the scene.
We had some 30,000, 50,000 people, I mean, literally, like, draped off the bridges and standing on top of pedestals and hanging onto telephone poles, hanging off there, waiting for this moment of the fire. These close to life-size Victorian houses were going to make clearly a spectacular blaze.
And what happened?
They didn't burn. They didn't burn. They didn't take flame. That spectacular blaze didn't happen, and it wasn't spectacular at all. Instead, it really fizzled.
After several failed attempts to burn the houses down, and after a delay of more than 20 minutes, the huge crowd was starting to get restless, and they finally gave up and moved on to the fireworks portion of the show.
So this fizzled out, as you said, in a very, very public way with a lot of people.
Over 30,000 people.
We're waiting for them to burn.
We're waiting and started chanting.
What
we want fire. We want fire.
Jim, and you were the guy, the responsible guy?
I was the responsible guy. It became a front page article every day of the week that followed. And that, you know, I just can't imagine anyone has the stomach for that. It's just uncomfortable, right? Uncomfortable.
Jim was mortified. Sure, the crowds and the TV cameras were disappointed, but Jim felt terrible for the hundreds of neighborhood volunteers and school kids and funders and staff who supported Red Moon as it stretched to pull the festival off. And this came during a sort of cult of failure era in our culture that's still with us today. Among policymakers, MBA programs, and tech startups, fail fast and fail often has become a mantra, a way to encourage risk. As a producer of live events, Jim Lasko made his living stepping out onto the high wire and felt kicked pretty hard. He decided to confront that paradox head on with an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune. I asked him about that decision and whether, despite all the big talk we get about daring greatly and getting up and dusting ourselves off once we've landed face down, if he felt stigmatized, marked as a loser.
The article you mentioned in the Tribune that I had written was really about my children and understanding that they went to school and heard stories about what a utter failure I was the night prior or the week prior, and understanding, like, this is a real teachable moment that's important for my kids and for the world. Like, we are in a moment's time, I believe, where there is an imperative to try the untried and to be willing to fail, because you don't get anywhere. Change is not possible without a willingness to fail.
And that's what we're talking about on today's show. Failure, the experience of it, the fear of it, coping with it, and what stays with you, even when you've bounced back from catastrophe. Like Jim and Red Moon did in September of 2015, when the Great Chicago Fire Festival resumed. The theme, grit and resilience. And this time, everything went up in flames. Whether it was the spectacular fizzle of the Great Chicago Fire Festival or an ice skater bungling up a triple axel, witnessing failure can make us cringe, but it can also make us laugh, and sometimes it is impossible to look away. That's the appeal of the internet phenomenon of the epic fail video, and you know what I'm talking about. YouTube is littered with them. Here's a popular theme right now, the hoverboard fail.
Let's go, ready?
Watch out!
Oh, are you okay, Mom?
Before I sat down with NHPR's weekend host and web culture guru Brady Carlson to talk about why fail videos are so engrossing, our producer Maureen McMurray wanted to make sure we were good and ready.
So what I've done is I scoured the internet for a fail compilation of fail videos. It's really hard to find. Actually, before I start, Virginia, have you ever seen a fail compilation?
Yes, I admit that I have seen them, and they made me feel dirty and feel like I should take a shower afterwards because I've witnessed humanity at its worst.
And Brady, have you?
It's pretty much all I do.
So here you go. I'll just play a few minutes of it. You can, you know, tell me when you've had enough.
Yeah, watch out for scooters, I guess.
Or oh, bad.
When you're on
motocross
scooters.
Bicycles. Oh, bad. Auto accidents are
Boy,
not funny.
I would never kick a vehicle next to me while I'm on a motorcycle. Drunk Guy Falls,
drunk
otherwise
guy
known
falls.
As 75% of the internet.
Oh. Did he get electrocuted?
Just got electrocuted. Boy, that even somehow beats falling.
Okay, go-kart video. This isn't going to end well. Ooh, go-kart.
Oh, jeez.
Skateboard delivery guy.
I'm unclear on the concept of the skateboarding delivery barista.
I'm really embarrassed at how much
it's so wrong and yet so right. Wow.
Okay, so after we wiped away tears of laughter, Brady and I discussed the allure and the origin of the fail video. He started by pointing out that even the lo-fi homegrown fail video uses a pretty predictable formula.
So there are certain tropes in these things. So even if I haven't seen, you know, half-naked drunk guy riding bike onto ramp into pond and falling on his head,
you'd
number 342, I've probably seen at least.
But isn't that funny that we actually know something terrible is going to happen and still the element of its horribleness catches us?
It's almost now at the point where you would be surprised if the guy landed correctly.
Right.
And splashed and everybody high-fived him.
Well, I think that's the whole question about failure that I find so fascinating, that triumphs are the thing that we're going for, right? But they're not as interesting as people failing.
Well, it's in a way, it's there's a couple of things going on, I think, because there is actually research about why we love fail videos, sort of the psychological motivations behind them. I mean, one piece of it is that it's comedy 101. It's the thing that you don't expect
slapstick.
To happen happens.
Mm-hmm.
And slapstick, is, you know, in most of these cases, it's perfect. You know, people falling down is funny, unless it's you.
Right.
But the other piece of it is apparently there's some kind of innate need for schadenfreude. We love watching other people fail. There's some need we have, and some research has actually suggested that it goes back to, you know, the primordial competition that if someone else is failing,
then you're succeeding.
Then we're succeeding. I mean, isn't that sort of the theory behind shows like Jerry Springer, that if you're watching these people whose lives are train wrecks, that you feel better about yourself? So in a way, fail videos are kind of a short form version of that, where we can feel like, well, I'm not the idiot who decided to ninja kick a pizza and fell on his head.
Well, some of them are so funny, but some are people really getting hurt. So what is the line between a funny fail and a just cruel fail?
I think part of it comes back to another comedy 101. You never punch down. So if somebody legitimately gets hurt, I mean, that's not really funny, I don't think. Unless they're not really that hurt or they did something that you could have seen this was going to go wrong.
Right, some big show of bravado.
So there's, yeah, there's a sort of a karmic aspect to it. They get their comeuppance. You know, the other piece of it is that, you know, the internet can be a rough place. You and I might see some of these fail videos and go, oh, somebody got hurt. That's not funny at all. That makes me feel horrible. But there are places like 4chan, you know, which is notorious for more reasons than I can even get into here, or even certain parts of Reddit where, you know, something where somebody gets legitimately hurt is like the point. You know, that's what they laugh at first. Mm-hmm. So mileage varies on the internet about what's funny and what's mean.
We can trace this back to early humans, but I started looking at fail. You know, I just Googled the word fail, and I got top hits for fail blog, epicfail.com, fail army, fail pics, ultimate fails, compilations. When did these become a thing?
Well, I think they started appearing in large numbers around the time that YouTube really took over the internet in 2005, because people started to realize that they could easily share videos of anything. They started to, including fails. I trace the attachment to that word fail with these videos when Failblog, the actual site Failblog, started in 2008. That's part of the Cheeseburger Network now, which is sort of a giant meme farm spanning a couple of different websites. But, I mean, like you said, this is not new to the internet. I mean, when I was a kid, there were basically failed TV shows. There was TV's Bloopers and Practical Jokes. There was America's Funniest Home Videos. So this goes back way before the web.
And they can get very specific online. There's, you know, a universe of them. Fails to satisfy any kind of taste. So what are some of the sites and blogs that out there that you enjoy?
Well, a longtime favorite of mine is Cake Rex, which has been chronicling the worst of cake decorators over the years.
Right, right. Tell us more about that. I mean, they're just so wonderful. You see these cakes that inspire you, you know, in a Martha Stewart magazine or something, and then they take photographs of what they really look
like.
Yeah,
and some of them are just not, you know, they look like I decorated them, you know, just not very well done. And other ones, they actually look nice, but there's something that the decorator misunderstood about what they were supposed to do. So there might be a cake in which a person had asked for the inscription section to just be left blank, and the decorator instead put the words "leave blank" on the cake in frosting. So, I mean, Cake Rex has been a huge success for years.
Where they run out of room.
Oh, they run out of room, yeah. Another site that I love is called Bad Newspaper. It used to be called Crigo. It takes the goofiest stuff from newspapers. A lot of headline fails, like Senior Center Holds Old Bag Sale. Just really bad stuff. Another one that I really love, which is hard to describe on the radio, but it's a Tumblr blog called Terrible Real Estate Agent Photographs. So how anyone thought any of these photos could sell houses, that's hard to explain. But, I mean, like you said, if those aren't your cup of tea, there's drunk people fail sites, there's animal fail sites, there's epic sports fail sites, there's every kind of fail site imaginable.
I'm speaking with Brady Carlson. He's NHPR's weekend host and our web culture guru. And we're talking about epic fails, the internet, and why it is so darn hard to look away from them. Since we both work in broadcasting, maybe we can admit that we take a certain pleasure in the reporter fails. Let's hear from some of those.
And certainly if we look at, you know, the changing complexion of this cabinet compared to the last one, the one yesterday, and what we can see is that
Adam,
men, so-called stale
males, do you want to take a pause?
Yep. No, I swallowed a fly. That's all right.
Well, I won't be talking to the rose expert anymore.
I know.
But you can ask me anything about peonies. I love peonies.
Oh, flowers. Peonies. Yeah. Yes.
Good morning.
It is Thursday, March 13th. You are Marcia.
I am. I almost jumped you there. Sorry about
that's
that.
Okay. You can jump me anytime. Not that way. Not that way.
Yes, we all have a moment like that. Just some of us haven't have had them happen on the air, right? I once mispronounced my own name on the radio, and I once gave this station's website as nhpr.mug. So reporter fails are dear to my heart.
I just can't remember ever having made a mistake on the air,
Brady. But I think you're the exception.
Well, of course, we all fail. And you talked about the sort of idea of loving to watch other people fail. But, you know, is there a less malevolent or less self-serving way of thinking of that, that we can forgive ourselves for our own failures when we witness other people doing it?
I like that idea. You know, there's the site Awkward Family Photos, for example, right? Because they have these photos where, you know, families are dressed up in costumes for really strange reasons. And, you know, you can laugh at them, but a lot of people are laughing with them because there are a lot of families out there who made their kids dress up in bunny suits for Christmas or whatever it was. So, I mean, sometimes it can be that feeling of recognition that, like, oh, I thought my family was the only really bizarre one out there. And here's this whole universe of people who share this common and incredibly bizarre experience.
You just got to put it to work and make money on
it. You got
to
work it.
You got to work it.
You got to own your brand.
Thank you so much for risking failing with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Veronica. I mean, Virginia. Oh, man. Epic public radio fail. Sorry.
Brady Carlson is NHPR's weekend host. He's the author of the new book, Dead Presidents, and he's our resident web Sherpa, let's say. Coming up after the break, our exploration of failure continues with the question of, is it something to learn from or avoid at all costs? We're going to talk about our culture's almost schizophrenic reaction to failure when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From sports to parenting to politics, we relish victories, but never forget failures. And that's what today's show is all about, coping with our failures. While we were planning this show, the Word of Mouth team talked a lot about the competing narratives we all seem to carry about failure. One is that it's necessary, it's positive. We have to take risks and fail and learn to fail in order to achieve success. The other is that failure is evidence of weakness or incompetence or a lack of will. That is the failure is not an option ever school of thought. Well, to discuss these somewhat schizophrenic messages that dominate in our culture, I have two guests with me. Jessica Leahy is a teacher. She's a New York Times columnist, Atlantic contributor, and author of The Gift of Failure. Jessica, always great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And joining us for the first time ever is Mike Pesca. He is host of Slate's podcast, The Gist. Mike, great to have you with us.
Hi.
Well, Mike, you talk about politics and sports and pop culture every single day on The Gist, and these are storylines that are often about wins and losses. So how do you define failure?
Well, the good thing about sports, let's contrast sports and politics and why I liked covering sports. There's no spinning it. There's no saying, oh, we're only two delegates behind. The losing Seahawks cannot really claim that they beat expectations and kind of won against the Patriots last year. No, it was the Patriots who jumped the route, got an interception, they won. So that's black and white. In politics, maybe up until the final election, but then there's spin involved too, certainly during all the debates. You could give a little sheen on if you failed or not, but I do think that there is a weirder thing going on with politics that we're probably experiencing today. You know, what really happens in these primaries, a few of them later on will be winner take all, but in the primaries and the caucuses, they're proportional. So we say, Bernie won or Hillary won, but they won two or three more delegates than the other candidate. And so the failure, as defined by the media, becomes much bigger than it really is as defined by the math. There is some truth to momentum, but mostly it is the media imbuing candidates with momentum. And also, the media so loves the comeback story that in some ways it is better to fail, especially when the failure is that you're trailing by three delegates out of 4,491.
All right, Jessica, how about you? Your definition.
Oh, it's great that Mike talked about the comeback story because, frankly, you know, as a teacher, you know, we have to write letters of recommendation and we have to talk to, you know, colleges about what this kid is like. And, you know, the people that just kind of coast along and never really take any chances and never try to do anything that's outside of their comfort zone, I don't really have that much interesting to say about them. It's those comeback stories that are really the ones where I say, man, you know, this kid was really struggling or this kid was coasting along. And then all of a sudden one day she just decided she was going to start going for it. And that's the sort of story that I love to be able to tell. And the problem is that we're so used to talking about these failures that end up being just disasters and kids don't know how to pick up the little pieces. What if my kid actually just fails out of school? these are such incredible opportunities to say, okay, well, what are you going to take with you? What are you going to reject? What worked? What didn't work? And how are we going to move forward and learn from the experience? Those are the search stories that I love to tell.
The teachable moments.
The teachable moments.
Well, reinforcing the kids won't die from failure. If we're talking about winning, this is a question for you, Mike. You know, sports, in the huddle, on the pitcher's mound, messages perform, win at all cost. But yet we're getting a lot of hand-wringing in sports and politics about especially how the grandstanding of winners is so unattractive or the sore losers. You know, give us some examples of graceful failures that you think have worked.
Well, so many great athletes and great teams will say that they are forged from failure, and without the early setback, they wouldn't be what they are. You know, Aaron Rodgers had to compete with Brett Favre to become the quarterback. Or I think about one of the great stories is a pitcher now for the Toronto Blue Jays. He won a Cy Young with the Mets, R.A. Dickey. And his life story is incredible because he was one of the best pitchers in college, just a flame-throwing fireballer, gets drafted really high. They do the pretty pro forma medical, and they find that he has no ulnar collateral ligament in his pitching arm. This is unheard of. They don't even know how he's not just by lifting a pencil in excruciating pain. But the team that drafts him just is really reluctant to sign him, and they kind of lowball him on an offer. It would seem like this is the only option he has. And he realizes he'll never be able to throw the heat and throw 90. He reinvents himself as a knuckleball pitcher, which is, you know, a crafty guy who kind of gives himself over in a zen-like manner to a pitch that controls you as much as you control it. But because of that huge setback, because of that failure, he is one of the most intellectual pitchers or players you'll ever meet, and it made him a great pitcher, you know? And he also has a new attitude towards greatness, which is not just that it's something innate, which is something I find with my kids, and that, you know, there's so much parenting advice, but a good piece of it is don't tell them you're smart, but tell them you worked hard. And if you emphasize the work that goes into it, the result might not matter that much, which is another thing in sports. Brad Stevens, the coach of the Celtics, always talks about the result being just the worst indication of if the process was good. So when we talk about failure, we probably focus too much on result without looking at the process. And we think the process must have been flawed if a failure resulted. And we think if a success was attained, the process must have been good. And that's often not the case.
I'm going to give this to Jessica, because when you were starting that story about failure made me who I am, she was doing the gag me sign.
Yeah.
Well, no, there's this one of my favorite books on the topic is Tim Harford's Adapt. And, you know, Tim talks in that book about how the way we look at the stumbles that we have along the way and the way that we adapt to those can dictate how we end up doing in the long run. If we ignore the mistakes we've made and we say, oh, no big deal, I'll just move on from here, without actually taking stock of what's gone wrong and how to fix it for next time, how to adapt yourself so that you can maybe reinvent yourself in a new direction or reinvent whatever it is you're trying to do in a new direction, that's what makes you successful in the end. Not so much, you know, the fact that you failed at all, but the way you adapted or reacted to that failure.
Well, I love
right.
this.
Right, that's a classic cliche from the job interview. Tell me about a failure and what you learned right. from it. So it helps to have that narrative. I mean, it's a cliche for a couple reasons, right? Either because we like to think it's true, but maybe there is a truth to it.
Right, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But there, you know, some people are allowed to come back, it feels like to me, or to come up from adversity. But when you are a big public figure and you fail, you know, Mike, I'm thinking, you know, Boston Red Sox first baseman Bill Buckner, right? He forever will be known for the slow rolling ball that went right through his legs in the 1986 World Series. Or Roberto Duran throwing up his hands and saying, you know, no mas, no more in the ring with Sugar Ray Leonard. I mean, what happened to them? Could they come back?
Well, I think Buckner was victimized by the fact that the Red Sox continued their streak of not winning it. And if they had won the series a couple years later, maybe he would have been welcomed back into the fold. In fact, I'm editing a book about sports what-ifs, and that is the great one. Maybe Bill Buckner would have been hired as a coach and taken the Red Sox to world championships in the 90s or something like that. I do, you know, sports is pretty cruel, but they do love the comeback story. And politics loves the comeback story. And as much as we say we are harsh about failures, Bill Clinton always calls himself the comeback kid, or he did, and that was a huge part of the narrative. So are we really that cruel? Are we really, as sports fans, unwilling to experience a comeback? Like I said in the beginning, sports are about wins and losses. So if Buckner had come back the next year and won a World Series, then we'd more than accept it. We'd celebrate it even harder.
Well, what you said about Clinton is really important. I mean, taking control of the narrative is one of the first big things you can do. You know, I talk a lot about my biggest failures when I'm talking about kids' failures because, you know, God knows I've had plenty of them. But, if you take control of that and make that part of your story, then that becomes a strength that becomes something that other people can understand in you and can see you as, the kind of person who can talk to them about failures because they understand that you've had them too. Taking control of your own story, I think, is the first most important step to dealing with failure.
Today's show is all about failure and how we cope with it as individuals, as a society, how we look at others who fail. And my guests are Jessica Leahy. She's a teacher and author of The Gift of Failure. And Mike Pesca is with us. He's a longtime sports reporter and host of Slate's podcast, The Gist. So we're talking a little bit about building up failure muscles in various different ways. But there's a lot of research on the fear of failure leading to, in sports, choking or tentative play. And Jessica, you describe, the failure-averse parents experiencing an adrenaline-fueled oncoming headlight glare, this desperate to prove their parenting skills. So how does that fear of failure actually change the way people approach life?
It's self-perpetuating. I mean, that anxiety that kids feel when they make a mistake is fueled by the fact that the parents tense up or the teacher or other students tense up when they make a mistake. So the entire attitude needs to just kind of shift more towards a long-term focus on, I want to get better at this thing as opposed to, oh my gosh, I just choked and that's it. It's all over for me.
Yeah. So we're talking, I guess, mostly about populations, high-achieving populations, mm-hmm. right? Populations where maybe the parents themselves are successful.
Right.
So do the parents not see it in themselves? Did the parents get to those levels of success because they failed and were forged by that failure? Or is it the case that, most of these parents themselves had kind of sweet lives where they didn't experience much failure?
I don't think that there's, and I hate to say this, I don't think there's a lot of self-reflection going on. I think what's happening is that a lot of parents are judging their own parenting worth based on praise that their children end up with, the award, the number of ribbons on the wall, that kind of thing. And so I think you're absolutely correct that a lot of parents see themselves as needing to perpetuate sort of this successful legacy moving forward. But at the same time, I think so much of this is put on the kids' shoulders because everything about the parent's self-worth as a parent is heaped on the narrow shoulders of these little kids. And I don't think that that's a fair thing to do to children, whether that's, a parent from a low-income bracket or a high-income bracket.
So is there a sort of shelf life on this, Jessica? I mean, at some point, teaching kids about winning becomes important more than failing?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this recently in Princeton when the superintendent or principal came out with a letter saying, we really need to relax a little bit. And there was some blowback from a few of the a few families in the community that said, no, there isn't any room for failure. And we're not interested in teaching our kids that you can relax. That's just not part of the narrative we'd like to put forward for our own children. And that that school district is really becoming divided over the message of we need to let up a little bit on these kids that are being pressured so intensely because some of the families are saying, no, we don't. We need to intensify, if anything else.
So what if I were to ask you about your capacity for failure, the job interview question for you?
I got lots of stories. I thought law school was going to be a breeze. And in my first year, I went weeping into my civil procedure professor's office because I had, I believe, a 68 on my exam. And that was because I just didn't think it was going to be that hard and didn't work that hard. And he said, well, how'd you do on the practice exam? And I said, practice exam? I didn't take the practice exam. He said, well, there's your problem. I think the problem is that we have a lot of kids who are feeling a lot of pressure and feel the need to look effortlessly perfect all the time. And I didn't want to take a practice exam because then it made it look like I had to work hard. And I didn't want anyone to think that about me.
Well, how about you, Mike? You put yourself out there as a broadcaster every single day. You're modeling something for your own kids, I'm sure.
Right. But, you know, for me, it was the 1992 Winter Olympics when I was a favorite in speed skating. And I felt, oh, no, wait, I'm thinking of Dan Jansen. I'm terrible at self-reflection, though. I like to engage in it. I never do it in the moment. When my kids do wrong, I cringe a little more than I should. But I don't think I overemphasize failure. Maybe I don't recognize it. But it is true that everything that didn't kill you makes you stronger. But on the other hand, it also made you incredibly weak. And it can do that too, right? And it's also true that behind every great success, there's a series of failures. But that's also true if you look at someone who is a failure. The last thing he did was fail.
Okay, lesson, fail early, fail often, what?
No, I think really it doesn't, how often you fail isn't really the point. It's really how you react to it. And some people, you know, we've been talking a lot about people that have big nets. Some people have bigger nets than others, and it's a lot riskier for people with the smaller nets and less room to be able to make mistakes. But at the same time, I'd like to use the word adapt a little bit more often. You know, if you're adapting to the mistakes you make and trying not to make those same mistakes again and become better, then that's really the most important way to look at the whole issue of failing.
So maybe that's a thing. You know, the word failure in itself, maybe there's far too much emphasis on the winners and losers, which would make sense for an educator, which would have Mike Pesca out of a job.
Well, you know, the reason the word failure's in the title of my book is I really actually wanted to desensitize people to it a little bit, because it's everything from the little stupid mistakes. My morning went terribly because I made a whole bunch of dumb little mistakes that hopefully I won't make again. But, you know, it can be big stuff, but it can also be little things that we need to, you know, make better next time.
What do you think, Mike? What's the media role in sort of playing up that winner and loser narrative?
Yeah, it's simple, isn't it? And, you know, it also strikes me that there are some activities for which the definition of failure are totally different than other activities. In sports, you know, if you're a hockey goalie and you stop 95% of the shots, you're actually not a very good goalie. But if you're a batter and you don't get a hit 70% of the time, you're called a 300 hitter and you're a pretty good hitter. So maybe that has to do with it too. And not just the media, but everyone with judgment and compassion. What about second chances? And what about saying about certain, you know, certain people have more resources, not just internally, but by class, by race? And how often do we give people the opportunity, you know, all those entrepreneurs and venture capitalist guys talk about all the times they failed? Well, a lot of them had a lot of funding and were told to do it again. So maybe we should start extending that idea more to more segments of the population.
Mike Pesca, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Mike Pesca, he's host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist. And Jessica Leahy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica Leahy's most recent book is called The Gift of Failure. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're talking about failure, which brings up one of the most famous movie quotes on the subject, and there are many. This one from the film Apollo 13.
We never lost an American in space. We're sure as hell not going to lose one on my watch. Failure is not an option.
Ed Harris there performing as real-life NASA flight director Gene Kranz, who led the successful return of three astronauts after an explosion aboard their spacecraft nearly turned a planned mission to the moon into a national tragedy. Throughout the ordeal, Kranz, or the actor playing him anyway, never acknowledges the possibility of failure.
This could be the worst disaster NASA's ever experienced.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
As inspiring as those lines may be, the truth is that failure, in some form or another, is always an option. Things go wrong, especially in outer space, which is exactly why there is a test called the Kobayashi Maru.
Captain's log, stardate 8130.3. Starship.
Okay, so I'm not talking about NASA anymore.
The Kobayashi Maru was introduced in Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, which, for my money, is the absolute best major motion picture of the entire Star Trek franchise.
And that is Janet Sten-Waddell. She's a professor of philosophy at San Jose State University.
So the overview is the Kobayashi Maru test presents a cadet with what looks like a no-win situation, although they don't realize it at the time.
So here's how it works. The cadet taking the test is captain of a fake ship, a working replica of the USS Enterprise used to train the crew by subjecting them to a number of fictional scenarios.
Project parabolic course to avoid entering neutral zone.
Aye, Captain.
Now, in this scenario, the fake USS Enterprise gets a distress call from a freighter called the Kobayashi Maru.
This is the Kobayashi Maru. 19 periods out of all tier 6.
Everybody aboard the freighter, which is stranded and is losing power, will die if they are not rescued.
This is the Starship Enterprise. Your message is breaking up. Can you give us your coordinates?
But here's the catch. The Kobayashi Maru is stranded in a so-called neutral zone. That is a territory which, if entered, could trigger a war with the Klingons, which for you non-Trekkies are the bad guys.
Mr. Sulu, plot an intercept course.
May I remind the captain that if the starship enters the zone...
I'm aware of my responsibilities, mister.
So the cadet is left with a choice. Leave the nearly 400 souls aboard the Kobayashi Maru to die, or attempt a rescue that would almost certainly leave even more people dead. In The Wrath of Khan, that cadet is Lieutenant Savick, played by Kirstie Alley. She decides to take the second, bolder option.
Evasive action!
All of a sudden, Klingon ships decloak. There's no good way to get out. Shots are fired. People go down on the bridge, and then we find out that it was a simulation. And as a cadet, she's feeling like she's failed.
And of course, that is how she is supposed to feel. Because in the Kobayashi Maru scenario, failure is not just an option, it is the only option. And only then, after the simulation has ended, does the real test begin.
Part of the point of the Kobayashi Maru is, what do you do after you face a loss? Do you throw up your hands and say, I'm done? Do you say this whole captaining a starship thing isn't for me because there will be conditions where I'm going to have to sustain losses? Or do you learn something from it that informs how you go forward?
I don't believe this was a fair test of my command abilities.
And why not?
Because there was no way to win.
A no-win situation is a possibility every commander may face. Has that never occurred to you?
No, sir. It has not.
And that voice you hear lecturing Savick on the purpose of the Kobayashi Maru belongs to none other than Captain James T. Kirk, Star Trek's bold, though impulsive, hero, played by William Shatner. He, as we find out later in the film, is the only Starfleet cadet to ever, quote, win the no-win scenario. But we're going to put that aside for just a bit. First, let's consider this. Can a test designed to prepare a person for failure really deliver? Can the consequences of real failure be experienced with what amounts to fake stakes? Is the Kobayashi Maru instructive for aspiring space explorers, or a somewhat sadistic experiment with dubious real-world applications? That's a line of inquiry that led us back to NASA, where, according to Gene Kranz anyway, failure is not an option.
We have a training division, and it's their job to train not only astronauts, but the flight controllers that respond to the systems on the ground side of things.
This is Chris Cassidy. He's a former Navy SEAL and an astronaut who spent more than 180 days in space. He's currently serving as NASA's chief astronaut.
Really, my main responsibility is to determine who goes on which missions, kind of the crew pairing and that sort of thing.
Okay, can I just jump in here?
That's my colleague Taylor Quimby. He spoke with Chris Cassidy, and he's picking up the next part of the story from here.
Now, just like in Star Trek, real astronauts use full-scale, functional mock-ups of their spacecraft in order to train for different scenarios. So let's imagine the spacecraft as a car. First, astronauts learn what all the stuff inside does, like the steering wheel, the pedals, etc.
Where the valves are and where the sensors are and what things you can interface with.
Then they open the hood, and they learn how all that stuff works. This is the radiator. Here's what it does. These are the parts of the engine. So on and so forth.
And once you get the hang of that, the training team will then inject malfunctions into the simulations.
So maybe ground control flips the check tire pressure light on. The astronauts stop, they check their tire pressure, maybe they put some air in the tires.
And then as you get more complicated, they do more integrated failures like an electrical system. Obviously, if you fail an electrical bus, it's going to have impacts to all of the systems on the vehicle.
Now, the check engine light is flashing, there's smoke coming from the hood, and the power windows aren't working. It's a total mess.
It's difficult if you're looking at open the hood of your car and you see steam coming out and you're trying to tell the mechanic on the phone, I don't know, there's just steam coming out of this metal thing.
Yeah.
But if you're able to say the cooling line that's entering the feed side of the radiator has broken, that's much more helpful to the mechanic.
None of this training is conducted with the expectation that crews, either on the ground or in space, can train for every imaginable scenario. There are just way too many to consider.
On a real flight, we don't know if it's going to be that thing that we simulated that broke. But that's not so important as how do you respond when something happens that you've never seen before.
So given that, how important do you think failure is to the process of training for spaceflight?
In training, we're going to have situations where the team doesn't figure it out correctly. And what's important to us is that then given the debrief and a little bit extra training, maybe then presented that same situation, those same team members respond to it correctly or in a different way or handle it better. So in the training aspect of it, I don't want to say that we want to fail, but we want to push our people to the very edge of their ability to keep up.
Do you think that a no-win scenario, a scenario in which a crew was put through a simulation that could only end badly, that can only end in failure, does that have any value in real-world applications to you?
It wouldn't be negative training, but we have limited amount of time and resources to prepare our crews for flight. We want to use that time most effectively. If we're just doing stuff that they can't ever succeed at, you know, where's really the value in that?
Yeah,
it's like training your little league team with a major league baseball pitcher and then batting practice. It doesn't help anybody. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so how would Chris Cassidy react should Mission Control throw a no-win scenario his way? He'd handle it like a pro.
What I would do is just go in that sim and fight the alligators that are closest to the boat and just keeping options open that might work.
In Star Trek Wrath of Khan, Captain Kirk takes a different tack. After taking the Kobayashi Maru multiple times, each time ending in failure, he begins to suspect the true nature of the test, that it is programmed to be unwinnable. So he reprograms it.
On the test, sir, will you tell me what you did? I would really like to know.
Lieutenant, you are looking at the only Starfleet cadet who ever beat the no-win scenario.
I don't like to lose.
Then you never faced that situation. Face death.
I don't believe in the no-win scenario.
Kirk says, I don't like to lose.
Again, philosophy professor Janet Stenwedel.
And that's well and good, but the whole rest of that movie has Kirk in a situation where he is not able to pop out of reality to reprogram the circumstances to win, at least not to win in a way where he gets to walk away with no casualties.
There's an interesting ongoing debate about how Kirk handled the Kobayashi Maru and whether what he did, reprogramming the test, should be considered cheating. In one way, he beat the unbeatable test. But if you look at it from Chris Cassidy's perspective, Kirk kind of missed the point.
It's almost like he passes the test's fake goals, but
right.
totally and utterly fails the test's actual goals.
Yep. I think there's a lot of context in which people do that in life. You know, they get 3 units for this college course and they don't really get what it's about, but they get the piece of paper that says they learned it, but, you know. So it's, yeah, it's a tension.
Jenny, you really don't like tests.
This may have something to do with the number of papers I have sitting in my office to grade.
Janet Sten-Whedell there. Earlier, we heard from NASA's chief astronaut, Chris Cassidy, and our thanks to both of them for being part of this story.
So since we're both in the studio, Virginia, do you have any good failure stories?
Oh, my God. I don't know if I can tell this story. It's really funny because I've been thinking about it a lot during, you know, our working on this show. Okay, so I was working for a public radio program. When a big film comes out, the press people put together a junket. And this was in 2006, and the film was A Prairie Home Companion, you know, which was kind of like, you know, it was the Robert Altman film.
Yeah, big, right? And a kind of a big to-do for NPR.
Big to-do for NPR, obviously. And so I went to this hotel room to interview a number of the stars.
Sure, yeah.
So there was Kevin Kline, John C. Reilly, Meryl Streep was there, Altman himself.
Yeah. Lindsay Lohan.
Lindsay Lohan was in this. She was not there, by the way. She was not on this little junket. So I went to get a kit, mini disc kit, right? They were quite light. You know, it was a sort of favored recording device, late 90s to the early aughts. The rule was you were supposed to replace the batteries every time you returned a kit. And, of course, people didn't always do them. And I meant to check that, but I didn't check it. And we're sitting there, and I have the recorder plugged in, and the host is doing a great interview, first with John C. Reilly. And then Meryl Streep comes in, and so we did this whole interview with Meryl Streep. You know, I never press stop. Then in comes Robert Altman, and I start to hear this little ground hum. You know, sometimes there's an electrical hum. You've heard this in your headphones recording something. So I pulled out the plug to go on battery, and like 3 seconds later, the battery died. And none of those three recordings, John C. Reilly, Meryl Streep, Robert Altman, registered onto the disc. When I realized it, I mentioned it to the host, who was really upset at me. You know, I went back to work the next day, and it was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible day. I thought I was going to get fired. I was so uncomfortable, and I felt so stupid.
You know, when you tell that story, it is clear how badly it still hurts you.
You can see it. But this is it, Taylor, every time. I mean, I love Meryl Streep. I always love Meryl Streep. Now I hear her name. I see her on an award show. You know, I hear she's in a new movie, and there is this just pang. And, you know, since then, the more people I've talked to about it, they all say, you know, someone lost an Al Gore interview when he was running for president, you know, someone I know. But, you know, they say that that's a mistake you make once. You will never, ever make that mistake again.
Have you ever made that mistake again?
Hells no.
Yeah.
Actually, here's what's happened. I do a lot less recording. I had an old friend who used to say, humility will find you. So whether or not you have it, there are things that you're going to do in your life that are going to set you up for a lesson in humility. You're going to screw up in some kind of way. And maybe that's what made the whole concept of this show so interesting to me, because it began with talking with a friend of mine who's an artist who's like working over and over and over in her studio trying to get something right and failing over and over again. And I just thought, how does somebody do that? And of course, it's the nature of what we do. You know, we're producing something every single day. And if it fails, you're screwed.
Yeah,
I mean, it has to happen. So I feel like I'm one of those people who does not have the stomach for failure.
Well, good thing you have a good team.
Yeah, thank goodness. Thank goodness this is being properly recorded right now. Well, that is all the catastrophes that we have time for today. You can check us out at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, on Twitter at wordofmouth. And in the spirit of the show, we've compiled a few of our funniest failed interviews from the past. You can check them out at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth gets back on the horse tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.